I'm joined today by Bill James. I don't think he needs much of an introduction. He's quite legendary. Bill, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, let's say, for the sake of the record.
Typically, these interviews start with how people got into baseball, right? So what were your kind of earliest memories of baseball as a child, and how did you really start getting deep into it?
Well, like most people in the 1950s, I had played baseball in backyards and with neighbors from the time I was 4 years old. The question is when I got into baseball as a spectator sport. The absolute first thing I can remember is being home from school and hearing it announced on the radio that Rocky Colavito had been traded for Harvey Keene. I didn't know who either Rocky Colavito or Harvey Keene was, but it seemed really interesting. A year after that, spring of 1961, I was totally captivated by baseball cards that came on the back of Post cereals. And I would have been 11 years old at the time. I went from 0 to 100 as a fan spectator in a period of about 2 weeks, I suppose.
Who were your favorite players back then?
Well, I can give you a list of them. Ron Sato, Jim Cott, Tito Francona, Yogi Berra. I'm sure there are others. Manny Minoso, very much. Instead, I didn't have a lot of information. I had their pictures from the baseball card and what was in daily newspapers, and I was building a background set of information on each player, but I didn't have a lot.
So when you were building a background, what were the types of things you were interested in when you were younger, looking at the player stats?
I went immediately to questions I didn't understand. Many of which I now realize many years later were questions that nobody understood. But I was puzzled by gaps in my understanding, which is normal. By the summer of 61, I was listening to baseball games on the radio every day. And the announcers then, as announcers now, had explanations for everything and interpretations of everything, many of which didn't make any sense. And even when you're 11 years old and you thought about what they were saying, you'd realize it didn't actually make a lot of sense. I suppose it took 2 or 3 years for the realization that a lot of the traditional wisdom of the game didn't make any sense to really sink in. The announcers for the 1961 Kansas City A's, who probably lost 100 games, I don't remember the exact number, but they would give you the impression that the fielders were great, the hitters were pretty good, and the pitchers were really good, but somehow they lost every day. And the only explanation for this phenomenon I could come up with is that the pitchers must be terrible hitters. Not really a sensible explanation, but it was what I could do when I was 11 years old. There are a lot of things like that that just didn't add up. So I got fascinated with trying to make them add up right.
Were there any sources out there that made more sense than others, almost like kind of inspired a way of thinking?
I loved Jim Murray. Jim Murray was an LA Times columnist. He's a great writer. And I loved reading his stuff. Although I think I always realized Jim was a great writer, but he didn't care whether it made sense or not. He cared whether it was a good line. He almost openly rejected the idea of closing logical circles. As a person whose inclination is always to try to close the logical circles, I was sort of annoyed by that. But on the other hand, I worship Jim Murray as a writer. So he would be number one guy. The local sports writer was a guy named Bob Henson, not national import, but he had a lot of influence on how I thought because he was the local runner.
Were there any players you thought were pretty wise when it came to the way they saw the game?
I don't remember that. I don't think I have an answer for that.
Well, I guess it wasn't Yogi Berra then.
Yogi was very wise, but you have to be older to understand why saying things that don't close loops actually makes sense, because that's the way the world is. What made Yogi special is that his mind worked a lot faster than his tongue. So his tongue was always expressing ideas that came from his mind, but they were way ahead of where his language was. It was fascinating.
Like, what was your relationship with the field of statistics? Just like in high school, for example?
It didn't exist. It wasn't. I mean, you mean baseball statistics, there was no such field. It absolutely didn't exist. Statistics in general, I'm not really interested in statistics as applies to anything other than baseball. I don't know that that's absolutely true. I do always try to organize the world in my own ways, and I guess everybody does. And I sometimes do use numbers to do that, but I'm not knowledgeable about statistics, nor do I often try to use them analytically, other than as applies to baseball.
When's the earliest time you remember that you were gathering information about baseball and you ended up asking an interesting question and then coming up with almost like the response yourself, like an interesting response to that using baseball statistics?
Well, there are two examples I'll give you, one of which I never realized was true until sometime in the last couple of months. I remember looking at the post serials in the 1961, and I remember being fascinated with the concept of who was similar to who. Jim Davenport's batting stats in that season are similar to Elston Howard's. And when I had a collection of probably 25 baseball cards, and that was basically all I knew about the sport, I focused on why is Jim Davenport's stats similar to Elston Howard. You have to understand, I didn't have any knowledge of the real differences between them. I didn't understand the implications of one of them being a shortstop / third baseman and the other one being a catcher, one of them being a player having an off year and another one having a normal year. Any of that, one of them being faster and the other one being slower. I didn't understand any of that. I just noticed that they were similar. And I also noticed that Dick Grote, National League Most Valuable Player, had similar batting stats to Pete Runnels, the American League batting champion in 1960. But Dick Grote was the most valuable player, and Runnels, the announcers on the broadcast game, spoke of him somewhat disrespectfully. Maybe not disrespectfully, but they didn't go out of their way to talk about how great he was. And so I was puzzled by why this was, why these two guys who had similar numbers in 1960 were regarded so differently. One of them was a shortstop, the other one's a second baseman, not really all that much different. What that implies is there's something missing from the stats. And that issue, what is it that we're missing here in the statistical representation, is one of the is the largest underlying driver of my career. It's always asking, what are we missing here? What are the stats not capturing that we could capture? But also the simple issue of who is similar to who led me eventually to create similarity scores, which are now something that are easily available in baseball and widely used in other sports all over the place. So it was that issue that arose very early in my interest in baseball, and really before I had any real understanding of baseball, spread to very wide, you know, spread like you pour a little bit of water on a very flat floor, it spreads over a long, wide space. So that would be one thing I would say. In 1965, the Dodgers won the World Series with Wes Parker playing first base. Wes Parker was a great glove man, but not any kind of a hitter. The next year, there was a brief period where they benched Wes Parker, played Dick Stewart at first base. Dick Stewart had been a tremendous hitter, but was a notorious fielder. And someone in the Sporting News wrote that Parker probably saved the Dodgers a hit per game with his glove, but that he was such a weak hitter that it was hard to keep him in the lineup. Well, I figured out that if Wes Parker had had one more hit per game, his batting average would have been 480 something. So in essence, the Dodgers were debating whether they would be able to keep a 480 hitter in the lineup. And this so annoyed me that I wrote like a 12 or 15 page letter to the editor of the Sporting News explaining why this didn't make any sense. Needless to say, they did not publish it. I was 15 years old. I didn't understand that editors don't publish 15 page letters from 15 year old kids. That was the first time I remember. I was a pretty argumentative person when I was young. And that's the first time I remember being bold enough to try to argue with the authorities about issues they cared so much about.
By authority, you mean just the baseball authorities or authority in general?
Baseball authorities. It's probably another 20 years till I was ready to argue with the people around the world.
I guess you were in high school and you started thinking about the authority as not necessarily being the end-all authority to information and statistics in baseball. How did you get deeper into baseball statistics, or did you put it aside for some time while you were doing other things in your career?
I was as obsessive about baseball as you can be, and I did try to put it aside, thinking I've got to focus on more important things in life. But that never worked. In college, I studied economics. Everybody's mind works in a certain way. And when I studied, let's say, biology, and they ask you to stare into those tubes and see some little animals in there, I wouldn't see nothing. In chemistry, when they ask you to pour stuff into tubes and it was supposed to turn purple, mine would turn black or not turn colors at all. Those disciplines just didn't make any sense to me. But economics always made sense to me. And I think economics is peculiar in that way, in that you either get it or you don't. And if you get it, it's so easy, it's ridiculous. And if you don't, it's impossible. Economics made sense to me. And the minute I began to study economics, I misapplied my education to study baseball instead. In essence, I took economic methods and converted them to baseball.
Yeah, I mean, with economics, do you credit the study in college with teaching you more formal statistical theory or forecasting principles? Or like, what did you get out of economics that?
A way of thinking. You have to remember how old I am. At the time that I studied economics, and I majored in economics, But economics at that time was not a heavily statistical field. Classes about economics sometimes didn't rely on any mathematical analysis of any kind. It would be like a lot of it was like the history of the labor movement or the history of the railroads in America, I mean, questions of it. Then it was almost totally irrelevant to modern economics. Econometrics was sweeping the planet at the time that I was in school. And I thought, oh, this makes sense. But I never really had much of an education in statistics or much of a background in it. And a lot of the methods, statistical methods that smart people use, I never understood. I was just always working with a kind of a rudimentary tool set.
So I guess after college, you ended up serving in the Army.
I was in the Army for a couple of years.
Did that impact your way of thinking about the world at all? Or was it more just something you had to do?
It was mostly just something I had to do. The only positive thing I got out of it was I worked closely with the first sergeant named Clarence Bray. And I worked closely with him in Korea for a year and learned a lot from him about how to manage what could be called business details. And which I learned more from him than I did from school, from college. But Korea is a long way from the baseball scene. So I did stay up until the middle of the night and watch the 1972 World Series on Japanese television. That's about all I remember from.
So then after the Army, what inspired you to start writing your baseball abstract?
This is not inspiration. I'd say frustration. I wanted to be a writer. I had always wanted to be a writer, but I lacked the confidence to try that. So I went back to school for a year. I liked being in college. After I got out of the Army, I went back to school for a year because I liked being in school, and I got a teaching certificate, imagining naively that I could teach school and build a career as a writer, which is actually a very difficult thing to do because teaching school is hard work and being a writer is hard work, and nobody has the time or energy to do both. But that's the way I was thinking at the time. I also wrote a few articles. The first article that I ever sent to a publisher was sent to the Baseball Digest, and it was accepted, and they paid me $60 for it, and it was published, which is a very good fortune, because I'm an easily discouraged person, and I had not had some. If my first article had been rejected, I don't know where I would have gone. I know people who wrote four books before they could get one of them published, you know? I'm not that kind of person. I'm not the kind of person who could write four books and wait for one of them to get published. I need some traction to keep me going.
Well, that's interesting that you say you're not an easily discouraged person, because maybe the public way of thinking about your story is that you were doing wonderful things for decades, and the baseball industry or the sports industry took a long time to start really adopting the type of techniques you were preaching.
Right. Well, there's a question of relative. I appreciate you saying they were wonderful things. That's a debatable point. There's a relative perception of success. Backing off to my first article, after I wrote a few articles, I remember writing an article and sending it to Baseball Digest, trying to explain some moderately sophisticated concept. It wasn't anything, you know, wasn't anything terrifically, but it was something that wasn't in the part of the mainstream of the stuff they published, and it wouldn't go anywhere. They didn't want it. Thank you for the articles you sent, and we'll get the next one, but we don't want this one. That sort of thing happened to me several times, and I thought, you know, I've got enough limitations of my own. I don't need these people imposing their limitations on me as well. I'm going to start my own publication and sell it myself. You have to understand, I have very low expectations. My father was a small town school janitor. And my brother was a truck driver. I was just trying to make a living. My only real ambition was not to have to do hard physical work. I wanted to have some sort of job where I could be inside during cold weather. So my notion was that in starting the abstract was that if I could sell 2,000 copies a year and make a profit of $10 on each one, that would be $20,000 a year. I could make a living doing that. That was about what an entry-level school teacher was paid at that time. And, you know, that was all I was really trying to do. Another thing you need to understand is that many, many, many people told me that I would never make a living doing this because there was no market for it. And there just weren't enough people who were interested in this kind of thing to make a living by doing it. Well, I knew that that was wrong, and I was willing to gamble my career, such as it was, on that being wrong. On the other hand, while I had I had not underestimated the market by as much as those people had. I had nonetheless underestimated how many people were interested in this stuff. It turned out that it wasn't 2,000 people across the country who would be interested in it. It was hundreds of thousands. All that came up years later. I wasn't trying to reach those hundreds of thousands of people who were interested in the subject. I was just trying to build a little niche market for myself such that I could make a modest living as a writer.
How many abstracts did you sell in the first issue?
70, I think.
How did you get it into stores?
It wasn't in stores. Bought a little ad in the Sporting News, the first version of which they refused to publish because they thought it was some sort of a scam. But I persuaded them that I wasn't. So they bought the ad and sold 70 copies. I would also note that this goes back a long time, but several early articles written about me said that I sold 70 copies, mostly to friends and family. It's not true at all. My friends and family didn't have any idea that I was even doing this. I never told anyone. I never told my relatives that I was doing this kind of thing because they would have thought I was nuts. So they were all sold to baseball fans. And I was somewhat discouraged that there were only 70 copies sold. But on the other hand, I'd only printed 200. So, it's 35%. But I was very much aware after having done the first one that I hadn't done a good job of it. I was very much aware that I didn't start on it early enough, that I didn't follow through on ideas, that I hadn't seen things that I could see after a year, and that I hadn't sold it in an appropriate manner. I decided to do one more. You can't imagine how, unless you've done it, how much work it is to write a book. I was willing to do that amount of work again because I knew that the idea was, I knew that I had not done a good job in the first one. This time I was working as a security guard, which is a good job for a young writer because being a security guard isn't really that much to do. You just walk around the place once in a while and make sure nobody's stealing anything. The second year I sold 200. The third year I sold 300. And the fourth year about 700 or something. So I was, relative to my modest goals, I was making progress. I was getting there. But also people, by this time I was becoming aware that the potential market was a lot larger than what I'd initially supposed.
So what did the community look like back then? Because this was before the internet. Were people corresponding with you who were reading your abstracts? Or how did you get in touch with people of like-minded interests?
Yes, I did sell the abstract out of my home and people did write to me. So by 1979, I was corresponding with probably 25, 30 other people who were interested in the subject. Yeah.
Did anybody else want to join you in this project and write articles or share ideas?
Well, I did by the 1980 or so. I did publish articles that other people had sent to me. Yes, you can go through those old books and you can find a few. Some people probably wanted to help me more than I accepted. And I probably could have done better than I did in terms of respecting and forwarding the suggestions of some of the people I was writing to me. On the other hand, to give myself credit for what I did do, I always understood that for me to succeed, there would have to be a field of knowledge rather than just a personal project. So I was always trying to portray this as a field of knowledge. And in the early abstracts, I sort of exaggerated, or even, let's not use the word falsified, but I sort of exaggerated how many people were kind of interested in this subject. And any work even vaguely related to it that was done by, Pete Palmer or Dick Kramer or Brian Johnson or anyone that I could find, I would quote from it or draw attention to it to try to to try to nurture the growth of a field as a kind of organized endeavor.
What did you call the field back then when you described it?
Well, I actually invented the word sabermetrics because people were calling it Jamesistics, which is a horrible combination, but also embarrassing. So I thought, oh, I can't let that happen. So I had to come up with another word. So I invented sabermetrics.
And where did that term come from?
I combined the name of the Society for American Baseball Research with metrics, meaning measurement, which is apparently a violation of several linguistic rules, because any number of people told me you can't combine an acronym with a Greek root. Doesn't make any sense. So, but I did anyway.
So then what were your interactions like with Saber in those days?
Before 1981, I enjoyed Saber meetings very much. It was like the only place I could go where I could actually meet with people who were interested in the same things and would talk about them. I'm not sure what the first Saber convention I attended was, probably 1976, and that may have been in Chicago, I don't know. But at that time, Saber was a very small organization, about 70 people, I think. And of that group, only three of us were interested in what became this field, the other two being Pete Palmer and Dick Kramer, both of whom I admire very much. They were both more educated than I am, and they were in Saber before I was, and publishing before I was. I was like a third wheel there, but I enjoyed that very much. And I enjoyed going to Saber conventions until, this is immodest, and I hate to say this, but it is true. In the early 1980s, after the publication of the first two national abstracts, almost every book published about baseball would have to give their opinion about me. So either I was a demon or I was a genius, or neither, which I am. It was uncomfortable. I'd never expected that sort of attention, and I didn't have any idea how to deal with it other than sit and eat. So I put on a lot of weight. But I'd go to a Saber convention, and all of a sudden I was somebody that I'd never intended to be. And everybody who spoke about anything had to give his opinion about me. And that wasn't very much fun. Saber conventions then became awkward, and I stopped going to them. But the first 4 or 5 years, I loved them. They were a lot of fun.
How did you become notorious? What was the thing that kind of left you into people's minds?
Dan Okrent. Dan Okrent, who I didn't know from, I never heard of, wrote me a letter in 1978. I got married on November 3, 1978. We went on a honeymoon. And when we came back, there was this letter from Dan Okrent there waiting for me. And he said, he talked about how much he liked the abstracts and said he wanted to help me build a reputation. He then, first of all, he opened a door for me to write the spring previews for Esquire magazine, which I did for 2 or 3 years, spring baseball previews, which exposed me to a degree to a national audience and helped me push my sales of the abstract up to 2,000. And then later he wrote an article about me for Sports Illustrated, which created a basis for me to get a national publisher for the abstracts.
How did this turn into people being so opinionated about you? What were the types of things people were thinking back then?
People are still opinionated about me. Part of it was the way I presented things. Sometimes I was not polite in my explanations. I regret this, but it's who I am. So that was part of it. And part of it was that the ideas, a lot of the way that I saw baseball was just not consistent with the way that 99% of the world saw baseball. And it's hard to get that now because the way that I see the game has become so widespread and so generally accepted that it's hard to envision a world in which nobody is expressing these kind of ideas, so they regard it as heresy. But I was a heretic. I was a person saying that, well, Dick Kramer before me said, I'm not sure there is any such thing as an ability to hit in the clutch. And I studied Dick's work and concluded, maybe there's something there, but we can't find it. That was a heretical idea, and it was controversial. And, Dick didn't have a national audience to advocate that idea, but I did. Stan Musial had said that he thought a player's prime was from ages 28 to 32, which is just flatly not true. Over 50% of players are retired before they're 32.
But it sounds like basically what you did was bring data into conclusions that people were making about baseball. You brought data into the conversation and would analyze what people were saying. So was it just that because you brought in this data and sometimes it contradicted people that might make an enemy? Is that what was going on?
Well, yes, that's true. Yes, that is what's going on, but I could explain it another way and you're missing a stream of it. I'm not a statistician. I've never been a statistician because I don't have that skill set, and that isn't really my interest. But the way that baseball statistics were understood before sabermetrics was as language. They created a set of standards, which was in its own way quite beautiful and immensely rich. What I mean by that is that 200 hits was a standard. 40 home runs was a standard. 30 home runs was a standard. Hitting 300 was a standard of excellence. 100 RBI was, 20 wins was, 200 strikeouts, 50 stolen bases. All of these things were standards of excellence. And all baseball statistics were interpreted all the time by where they stood with respect to those standards of excellence. And it wasn't that 200 hits was something and 199 hits was nothing. It was that the fact that 200 hits was such a marvelous standard of excellence, that 199 hits was also a standard of excellence because it was so close to 200. This was using 40 home runs did not actually refer to 40 of anything in people's mind. It meant power. I mean, 30 home runs meant power and 40 home runs meant great power. And to demonstrate that this is true, think about this. You can create an image of a player who's fast or slow, a player who is injured or healthy, a player who is consistent or inconsistent, just based on numbers. And those numbers, the interpretation of standards, gave the existence of this network of standards gave the numbers the powers of language, and people used them as language entirely. What I was doing was new, and I was using them as numbers. I was using them as statistics to provide evidence about issues that we discussed. And this was entirely new in the world. I mean, it sounds absurd, but it was. The idea that you could use these numbers to question the wisdom of experts. I mean, who are you to argue with Stan Musial? Love Stan Musial. I didn't in any way mean to insult him by pointing out he was wrong about this. The idea of using the numbers as actual numbers, as everybody else in the world uses numbers, rather than using them as a language, was somehow a threat to the poetry of the game.
I want to go back to what you said about how you say you're not a statistician. why do you consider yourself not to be a statistician when, you know, there's a range of baseball statistics that have essentially inspired a modern renaissance in sports statistics in general?
Right. That is true. But there are two reasons I would say I'm not a statistician. One is I'm not trained a statistician. I don't use or understand normal statisticians use. I mean, I understand a little bit of it, but know what a standard deviation is, you know, that's about the limit of it. But the other is that people think that I write about statistics. I never write about statistics. What I write about is issues. Research is a pathway between a question and an answer. In 90% of cases, not all cases, but in most cases, that pathway is paved with statistics. I mean, you come up with a question, not a question about statistics, but a question about baseball, such as, you know, at what age do players reach their peak, or how many players are retired by the age of 35? And you pursue that question. You pursue that question, of course, through statistics. And when you are done, you have a new statistic, which is a new percentage. But it is not the statistics that are of interest. It is the question and the answer. I don't think people understand that. I've never been a person who figured statistics for a living. A statistician keeps track of records. I work with people who do that, and I come up with ideas of things they could measure. As doing that myself, I never did.
Well, maybe in the modern parlance, you would be called a data scientist, because I think that's more about practical problem solving with data.
That's nice of you, but then I could never call myself a scientist either, because I don't have the, I mean, I have 1960s, 1970s training in economics, which is barely qualified as a science anyway. I could never call myself a scientist because I don't have the training to be one. I do have the mindset of a scientist. I do believe that by my nature, I have the mindset of a scientist, which is that I say that, okay, these people think, here is a question. This group of people thinks one way. This group of people thinks another way. What is the evidence? And I will believe what the evidence tells me. And that is the general, and I will use as much discipline and rigor as is necessary and as I'm capable of to find that answer, which I think is the mindset of a scientist. But I don't have the training of a good scientist.
I think if you had formal training, it could have killed your creativity.
It would have, yes.
So you were mentioning that you got picked up by a national publisher. You had a lot of notoriety. The sales exploded. Why did you decide to stop publishing the baseball abstract?
I was unhappy. I had my first child was born in 1986. And I'm grateful that I had a period of more success than I ever expected to have. I'm grateful that that happened, that period 1981 to 1988 or whatever. But I didn't enjoy anything about it. I didn't have preparation for it. I didn't have any kind of support staff. It overwhelmed me and made my life not that happy, so that I just had to move on. And I'm glad I did. I wish I'd moved on sooner, actually.
As you got more popular and more people were reading what you were saying, were you thinking about approaching teams, or did you have conversations with teams? Like, what was it like kind of communicating your ideas to the quote-unquote professionals?
No, I didn't. Well, some teams did reach out to me. There were several teams that reached out to me before Moneyball. I may be starting but I worked in baseball arbitration cases from 1979 till about 1990. And that was tremendously important to my career. Not that I ever made a large amount of money doing it, but it was tremendously important in demonstrating to the baseball community the value of this set of ideas. if you think about it, an arbitrator's view of the case is exactly like my view of the case. Players' agents say that the player's value is this, X, and the team says that his value is Y. So what are the facts here? That's exactly my way of viewing the world. Exactly. So it was a wonder, whereas the publishing stuff was kind of a pain in the ass, the arbitration experience was generally wonderful because everybody else in the room all of a sudden was trying to play my game. I mean, we get into an arbitration case and everybody else suddenly was trying to do the stuff that I'd been doing for 20 years. And I knew exactly what I was doing and they didn't. It was great. The only bad side of it is that it tended to drive salaries up. And not that I had any significant role in that, but I helped and I never felt great about that. And I really stopped working in it because, you know, when first arbitration case I worked in was Denny Walling in 1979. And I think he was asking for $64,000 and the team was offering him $36,000. Not sure those numbers are right, but I felt good about helping Denny Walling make a little bit of money. He'd been in baseball for 8 or 10 years by this time, you know. By the last arbitration case I can remember working on was a third year player who was asking for $4 million. And I couldn't really relate to that, very much against opposed to greed. Greed does immense harm to the world. And sitting in a room full of greedy people arguing about money is not really a place that I'm all that comfortable. So I loved it at the start. It was wonderful for a few years and then wasn't anymore.
Even though you weren't interested in helping determine player values, did you have any interest in helping almost like correct the thinking of a management of a team?
I never assumed that that was possible. When I started the abstract, you couldn't imagine how many people told me, well, almost these exact words from a large number of people that I knew, that, you know, I think the work you do is really fascinating, but you're never going to make a living doing it because there just aren't that many people interested in it. I knew that that was false on one level. My only ambition was to make a living by doing it. And I just assumed that those experts who I'd grown up listening to, that they would never pay any attention to it and that it would never become accepted. I shouldn't overstate that because I do remember on very simple issues, getting back to the age spectrum, for example, when I just studied the age at which players reached their prime and came out with conclusive evidence that it's not 28 to 32, it's more like 26 to 30. I naively imagined that people would stop saying it was 28 to 32, which of course they did not. I never thought at all that general managers would ever pay any attention to me, or that the field of knowledge would grow so large and so pervasive that people would have to pay attention to it. I just did not see that coming at all.
You had, over the years, it grew into thousands and thousands of readers of Baseball Abstract. Who were some of these readers that ended up going on to be in professional baseball that kind of surprised that you influenced them?
You'd have to ask them. I wouldn't want to give you any names because this is implicitly taking credit for what they've done. And I don't want to do that. If anybody else was influenced by my work or benefited from it, it's up to them to say that, not me. I will tell you that after I was hired by the Red Sox and I would go to spring training, I'd sit in the scout seats and watch spring training games. It was very common for old scouts to say, come over to me and say, Ms. James, honored to meet you. I've been reading your stuff since way before anybody knew about it. And they'd tell me that they read the 1978 abstract or something. It was really common. And, you know, I don't doubt that they were telling the truth. But like me, they were so overwhelmed by the numbers against them that at the time they were really silent about it.
If people like them are reading this and thinking similar things, what do you think ended up changing baseball so that it ended up accepting it?
I understand now that what I didn't understand then, which is that experts are always going to be the last people in any field to accept new ideas. And the reason that's true is, and for example, I'm fascinated by crime stories, and I read stories about horrible crimes and sometimes write them. You see the same thing in police work, that detectives are the last people to accept what seem like obvious innovations. So there are innovations in the field, and the absolute last people to buy them will be the FBI. And before the FBI, before the FBI gets to them, eventually some local police force somewhere will start saying, "Well, that's kind of interesting. Let's try that." And when it works, then a state crime lab somewhere will start working on it, and eventually it'll get to the point where it's, I shouldn't say the FBI is the last people, because it's possible that Scotland Yard will be even later. I don't know. Innovations start on the fringes and don't become mainstream until it becomes overwhelmingly obvious that people are telling the truth.
I guess the conventional narrative might be that Michael Lewis published Moneyball, it became a movie, and then it was too hard to ignore.
Right.
Do you agree with that conventional wisdom, or do you think there's a more complicated story behind it?
There's a more complicated story behind it, of course, but it's not a false story. It's just a simplification of the real story. Michael did tremendous work, and his work was of great value to me. Very much appreciative of that. But there were large numbers of people. The number of people reaching out to me from inside the baseball community was growing from 1979 onward. And by 1999, it was quite a few. There had been two teams that had tried to hire me before the Red Sox did, and I didn't work with them because they didn't really understand what I was doing. They wanted me to go away and figure something, it wouldn't have worked. So I didn't do it.
When you joined the Red Sox, how did you feel then compared to back in your arbitration days? Like, was there a shift in thinking?
John Henry, who was the principal owner of the Red Sox, had been reading my stuff for years, and he had a true understanding of it. I was actually hired by the Red Sox before Theo became the general manager. At the time when I was hired, they had an interim general manager. But from the first day I got there, it was obvious to me that Theo was going to be the general manager. And Theo had been reading my stuff since he was 10 years old and understood it as well as I did. So talking to them, these people understand who I am and what I can work with these guys. So that set up another wonderful period in my career. And my entire career has been shot through with luck to an extent that's difficult for anybody to believe. I realized immediately that I could work with these guys. And also, it was a lot of fun because I never worried about anything while working with the Red Sox, because I was never actually making decisions. I was just making suggestions, you know. There's a lot less pressure in that way. But also, I knew these guys were going to succeed. I mean, the day I got there, the success that we later had was not ever a surprise to me. I knew from the day I got there that these guys are going to win. And so, you know, something would happen like in 2002 there, or 2003, there was a misinterpretation of the record of things that he'd said, so that a lot of people believed that I had advocated for the bullpen by committee. First of all, I never advocated for a bullpen by committee, not publicly, not privately, not anywhere. The Boston public believed that I had because of some things that were written. And the Red Sox were using a kind of bullpen by committee, and it was a disaster. Didn't worry me at all, because I knew that we were going to succeed. And I figured that, well, you know, if I'm getting credit for this, then that has to work to my benefit once we start winning some things here. I knew we would, so I didn't worry about it at all. Sort of the opposite I enjoyed even the failures in Boston, because whereas my success in the early 80s was difficult for me, and it's not something I could enjoy or appreciate, the success with the Red Sox was just all fun for a long time.
did you get a sense that management of baseball teams was risk adverse in the sense of, I guess a sports analogy is when somebody goes for on fourth and one and they don't do well, the fans raise hell, right? Even though statistics might seem otherwise. Baseball decisions that could be informed by statistics that might seem controversial if a manager is doing it for the first time. Did you feel like maybe people were afraid of the fans, which is why they didn't actively employ more data-driven decisions?
Yeah, certainly. Many people are afraid of the talk shows, so they don't do what is logical because they're afraid of the talk shows, which, if I can point this out, this is one reason the Tampa Bay Rays are so successful, because their fan base is so weak that they are able to just ignore it and do whatever the hell the analysts tell them that it would be the thing, would be a productive way to spend their money. So they can have a player who has a really good year, and the fan base in any other town would be clamoring for you to please sign him, and they don't have the money to sign him. So they just trade him and they don't worry about it because there's no fan base there to worry about. I mean, not to put them down, eventually, if they keep working at it, eventually they will develop some sort of a fan base. But it's so weak that they're able to do whatever they want. So your observation is exactly right, that many organizations mismanage their teams because they're afraid to do what is logical, because they think some fan won't like it. But what the fans like is winning. So as long as you win in the end, the fans are going to get over their complaints.
How have you seen the fans change over the years?
One of my good friends is general manager in the NBA, Daryl Morey. Daryl is one of the prime advocates of shooting 3 points. I mean, if you shoot 3-pointers at a really high percentage, it's more effective than shooting 2-pointers. My wife, on the other hand, and she's a huge college basketball fan, she doesn't like people shooting threes. So whenever we get into a game and we're in trouble, the Jayhawks, we're shooting threes, she's always like, I wish they'd quit doing that. Stop throwing up those threes and play basketball, which, you know, I just ignore. But I understand that sort of impulse from a fan because I am a fan. I understand that I don't like it when teams use openers because I want to see the starting pitcher work seven at least. So I understand that facts have tremendous power. This is one of the things I learned from studying economics. People who resist economic realities pay a terrible price for that. People who believe so much in things they are taught by their father wind up investing in dying businesses because they deny that they're dying. You know, I didn't create that syndrome. I get blamed by it, by those people's grandchildren. But, you know, it's just the way that it is, that facts have tremendous power. And eventually the person who is acting on the basis of a true understanding is going to beat the guy who's acting on the basis of his grandfather's wisdom. And there's not very much anybody can do about it.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention about parts of the story you think we might have missed?
Well, a huge part of my career that I left out is could be called the John DeWan theme of it. John DeWan, when in 1983 abstract, maybe 82, I don't know. In one of the early abstract, I was always trying to gather data in order to study things. When I started this, the Elias Bureau controlled score sheets and controlled the data, and they had a plan for how they were going to market this and how they were going to, and that plan didn't involve me. So I would ask what I thought were simple questions like, could I get the score sheets from your games? I would write to the teams and ask them, could I get the score sheets from your games last year? Which seemed like a simple question. And, you know, say, I'll be willing to pay you whatever it costs you to send me this information. They would say, no, we can't do that. We're contractually obligated to the Elias Bureau. We can only send them to them. So I would contact the Elias Bureau with what seemed to me like an obvious question, which is, what would it cost me to get access to all those score sheets? And they said, no, you can't get access to them. We have access to them and nobody else can. Well, I thought that was really offensive. I mean, if you want to control the records of the game, perhaps you should close the stadiums and play them with no witnesses. That would give you better control of it. So I put up with that for about as long as I wanted to put up with it, which is 1975 to 1982. And then I decided, okay, that's enough of that. And I decided to organize a network of fans who would score the games and make them public record. Yes, that's right. The score sheets in Major League games in 1982 were not public record because they all went to the Elias Bureau and the Elias Bureau would not share them with you, would not allow them to be made public. I organized something called Project Score Sheet, which is a network of fans to score games and share the score sheets and make them public record. After a couple of false starts, John DeWan stepped forward to lead Project Score Sheet. John DeWan has the skills of a businessman, which I do not. I do not have any skills as a businessman to speak of. Project Score Sheet went in a different direction. And John started working with a private business, which is Stats Inc. I was an early was one of the original investors in Stats Inc. Stats Inc. then became a publisher for me after I stopped working with the national publishers and became a business partner for me. John and I still work together to this day. And that theme of my career is as important as any other. It's more central to the story of my career than say the Red Sox or Moneyball. And it doesn't get told a lot, but a lot of the statistical work that I do, all the hard stuff, all the groundwork is done by now Sports Info Solutions and earlier Stats Inc. and John's company. And they have sustained me and carried me forward. They've knitted my career together. So I would be remiss if I didn't see that part of the story was included in this.
And by that, you mean it's almost like you were trying to democratize baseball statistics, have it more widely available? Is that what inspired you to?
In 1982, absolutely. I mean, that was completely central to what I was doing. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you for joining me today. Great talking to you. And I'm sure fans are really appreciative that you shared your story.